From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1975 when a British comedy troupe released its second movie on the world. Its first film was more of a collection of previous sketches, but this was different. A feature-length film documenting the heroics of King Arthur and the knights, brave and not, of Camelot. It was called Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It was an instant success in both the United States and Europe, and it's hard to think of a more heavily quoted movie than this one. The film inspired comedians and writers, and it helped cement the Monty Python team as they continued to produce work in various venues. One of the stars, of course, is John Cleese, who is coming to Rochester. The Kodak Center is bringing John Cleese and a screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Cleese has done this in dozens of cities where he enjoys engaging with audiences. He asks and answers all kinds of questions on just about any subject. And coming up in about 10 minutes, John Cleese will join us right here on Connections. Let me introduce our guests in studio with us this hour. Chris Thompson is a comedian who's done all kinds of work in the field. He's got a lot to say about satire, comedy, and the legacy of Monty Python. Nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Allison Roberts is the founder of Estrofest Comedy Troupe and the co-founder of Impact Interactive. Allison, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Terry Brown is professor emeritus of theater at SUNY Geneseo and author of Playwrights Theater, the English Stage Company at the Royal Court Theater. Dr. Brown, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
When you think of Monty Python, your word was anarchic. Anarchy. Why?
Why? Because they're a wild, wild bunch, even though they are written down and that they're pretty together, and they do rehearse and they get it all together. But their humor is anarchic, as is a lot of British humor, and they go way, way back in tradition. I'm a professor, but kind of by accident an academic, because I went about doing what I wanted to do, and it just turned out that way. But my kind of sense of humor is that way, too. I'm kind of anarchic, as a lot of people will tell you.
So they're right up your alley, it seems.
They are right up my alley.
And, there are some Americans who go, I don't really get it, or I don't know if I... Chris, do you view them as groundbreaking?
I do. I think they're pioneers, at least in the 20th century, they're pioneers of, alt comedy. The modern alt comedy that's going on today is... You can... draw a line and link it to what they were doing in the 70s.
And what are some examples you see?
There are shows. We were just talking about the Santa Clarita Diet, which is about an average family, except the wife turns out to be a zombie. And they make it work. It's hilarious. Shows like Rick and Morty, which they hit... With Rick and Morty, they hit a lot of real-life, serious, grave things, but they do it in an extremely absurd way with a genius grandfather and a grandson who are kind of just problematic. The entire show is problematic, but on purpose.
So the absurdism you see as echoes is from Monty Python?
Yes.
Okay. And then there's a lot more to we're gonna kind of hark back to and discuss this hour. And for someone who writes a lot of sketch comedy, Allie Roberts, how do you view the impact and the legacy of Monty Python?
I started thinking about this last night, and I realized that actually I think they had a bigger impact on me personally. On comedy in general as a whole, certainly. Based on the time that they were coming out, the late 60s, when everything was sort of a pushback, stabbing at people with comedy. But it was more than that. It was the introduction of the animations that were part of that show, and that whole surreal... The surreal art around the...
I always assumed that was just drugs.
Yeah, well...
I don't know.
Very well, maybe. But that came out of... they're all entwined to me. And, I can remember being a kid watching it and being just fascinated by the graphics and the silliness and the physical comedy, which is my favorite thing ever. So all of that stuff stuck with me as a kid. And I realized last night when I was thinking this through, I was like... They had a bigger impact on me personally than I even realized in terms of my own comedy.
Yeah, one of the things I'm going to ask John Cleese is how much improvisation was happening and how much was scripted, particularly in a film like Monty Python, but also in some of the sketches. And I want to listen to a clip of one of my favorite sketches. This is all about the argument. And I wonder, you know, this is 40 years ago, how prescient this feels now. So you got a guy who goes into an office willing to pay a few quid to argue with someone.
Yes.
And he goes in and John Cleese is there ready to receive the argument. Let's listen to how it goes down.
Yes. Anyway, I did.
You most certainly did not.
Now, let's get one thing quite clear. I most definitely told you.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
No, this is an argument.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. It's just contradiction.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
It is not.
It is. You just contradicted me.
No, I didn't.
Oh, you did.
No.
You did, just
no,
then.
No, nonsense.
Oh, look, this is futile.
No, it isn't.
I came here for a good argument.
No, you didn't. You came here for an argument.
Well, an argument's not the same as contradiction.
Can be.
No, it can't. An argument is a connected series of statements to establish a definite proposition.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. It isn't just contradiction.
Look, if I argue with you, I must take up a contrary position.
But it isn't just saying no, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Argument's an intellectual process. Contradiction is just the automatic gainsaying of anything the other person says.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
Not at all.
No, look.
Thank you.
What?
That's it. Morning.
I was just getting interested.
Sorry, the 5 minutes is up.
That was never 5 minutes just now.
I'm afraid it was.
No, it wasn't.
Sorry, I'm not allowed to argue anymore.
What?
If you want me to go on arguing, you'll have to pay for another 5 minutes.
But that was never 5 minutes just now. Oh, come on.
So that's from a sketch, The Argument. You're dying over here, Terry. That's,
well, you just said the title of the thing, and I started to laugh before they even started the sketch.
And when's the last time you watched that?
God, I don't know. It's been a long time.
Still pretty good, isn't it?
It is. It's very funny.
I think it would land beautifully just today. And I don't know if all of the sketches would. Obviously, time ages everything, but that one feels scary to me.
But just mentioning the title, and they're so in my brain.
The Argument, yeah.
It make me start to laugh.
Yeah, yeah. Allison Roberts, from a sketch perspective, that sounds scripted because you got to be very, you know, there's a real flow to that kind of a scene that doesn't sound as improvised as it would be scripted. But why does it work or not work for you?
It's so funny. I wrote that down with a star next to it as one of my favorite.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did. It's there right here. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. It's brilliant in its simplicity, but it's like one of my favorite parts of that is that he walks in the first room and it's like he just gets attacked with a litany of abuse and the guy's like, oh no, I'm sorry, this is abuse. You know, he came in the wrong room.
But
just, like,
no,
just it's I don't even know why it's so brilliant. It's just so brilliant. It could work anytime, anywhere, right now. And the fact that you can get into as much abuse and language as you want under the guise of, but you paid for it and it's set up and, you know, you're here for the argument, you paid for it, and it's just, I don't know. It's
And so here's where, Chris Thompson, if I'm thinking to myself, boy, 40 years ago, I guess the level of discourse wasn't that strong, but at least today, no, we haven't made any progress. Mm. That just feels way too familiar today.
Yeah, they basically invented Twitter right there.
Exactly.
That's exactly what it. Yeah. I don't know how many times, and I've done this. This has happened with friends of mine. We'll sit there and go back and forth. We both agree to the point the same thing, but just because of one synonym, mm-hmm. we'll go back and forth, and then we'll say we're saying the same thing, and then somebody will be like, "No, we're not," and we're like, "Yes, we are." Like, this is pointless. Everything we're doing is pointless.
It's the invention of Twitter.
It's beautiful.
Right, it's so good. You know who would be great at that, by the way? Veronica Volk, a brilliant WXXI reporter who can argue anything. She turns it into sport. I say that lovingly. She's so smart. But it's also, I think, a wonderful demonstration of how frustrating argument can be when it just devolves into this yes, no, yes, no. And that's really what Twitter has become.
Yes.
You know who's on Twitter a lot, by the way? John Cleese, whom we talked to him in about 4 minutes' time. Uh-huh. I'm going to be quoting his Twitter feed from just this morning. And to his credit, he does more than just Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, mm-hmm. it is. No, it isn't. Are there other sketches? I could have walked in here and done the Department of Silly Walks right into the building, by the way, Terry, which one of their most famous sketches was, you know, the Department of Silly Walks, which until watching it again last night for the first time in years, I didn't realize was also a commentary on how stupid government funding tends to be and where we prioritize it. I just thought it was funny walks when I was a kid watching it when I was growing up.
Oh, yes.
Do you have other favorite sketches that come to mind for you?
Oh, you shouldn't put me on the spot. There's so many of them.
Allison Roberts?
Well, the silly walks thing, I just want to say quickly, I don't know if this is true, but I understand that it wasn't one of Mr. Cleese's favorite.
Oh,
because we can ask him, because he thought it was a little too cheap, I guess. To me, it's hysterical. And yes, it's talking about the ridiculousness of government and grants, coming up with grants for absolutely everything in the most mundane, silly walks. But to me, that skit stands out above almost all of them because it is because of the physicality of it. It's just hysterical.
Yeah, I've said to many people in this town, Allie Roberts is one of the best physical comedians you'll ever see. So I'm not surprised to see you key in on the physical aspect.
Thanks,
of
Evan. It is so funny. There is something so subtle and brilliant about somebody being able to move their body in a way that just makes you laugh hysterically.
By the way, when you watch that scene, do you think there's got to be a lot of improvisation, or do you think they're actually working on perfecting the silliness of those walks?
Don't you think it starts out with a lot
just
of
do
improv?
Do whatever you want,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. A lot of improv just, and then working into something.
Your joints are just going.
Yeah, don't you think, Chris?
That's
and the dead parrot sketch in which they dead parrot
the
sketch.
The dead parrot, yeah.
In which they deny the obvious.
Ah, that's a great one. Yes. Denying the obvious is another thing that happens every day in this country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's like crowd size. It's as if the dead parrot sketch the dead parrot sketch was like the forerunner for crowd size at inaugurations. It's like Monty Python could see the future, except for it was the future of this country.
Well, kind of theirs, too. They Brexited before we Trumped.
It's a good point. And you see parallels between Brexit and Trumpism.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's worldwide, but it's, I don't know. We've hit a peak. And, like, getting back to, like, the, you know, the ridiculous of, like, the dead parrot thing. Also, the witch hunt, the witch hunt part in
Holy
Grail.
The Holy Grail, yeah.
Where all the evidence showed that she wasn't a witch, and their use to prove that she is completely unscientific, but that's what they use.
See, that's climate change. So that's the that's climate denialism. So Monty Python actually was the forerunner for Brexit, some of the debates in modern politics. I don't mean to get too political. Climate denialism and Twitter. So far, we've established that they were 40 years ahead of the time. Let's bring in John Cleese and ask him. John, you're very kind with your time, and everyone in Rochester is looking forward to the visit here. First of all, how are you? Thank you for taking the time for the program.
Well, thank you. I suddenly realized it's 8 minutes because my first wife, Connie Booth, who played the witch that you were just talking about in Holy Grail, lived in Rochester. And we have a grandchild together called Evan. So I feel part of the Rochester family.
Well, very good.
That's amazing.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, John Cleese on the line with us is coming to Rochester on Friday, July 27th, for a screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And then John will do a Q&A. He enjoys engaging with audiences on all kinds of subjects. And he's kind enough with his time for us on this program today. So, John, I go back, and we've been talking about sort of the origins and the impact of Monty Python. And different comedic schools have offered different approaches to comedy. Upright Citizens Brigade's about finding the game of the scene. Groundlings focuses a lot on creating characters. Second City looks at sort of satire and finding a way to say something about the world. Did you look at Monty Python as being categorized in any way, or did it sort of fluctuate among those different ideas?
No, I think one of the reasons that everybody now is able to say that it was a sort of a breakthrough to a different type of humor was that we didn't know what we were going to do. We literally didn't. And it's, I think it's, you know, I do little lectures on creativity, and it just occurred to me in the last 10 years. I mean, we went in to see a guy who ran BBC Comedy, and he said, I understand you guys would like to do a series. And we said, we'd like to very much, Mr. Bells. He asked us, well, what do you propose doing? And we hadn't discussed it. I mean, there was this embarrassed silence. We ad-libbed. We said, you know, well, we want to do a comedy show with humorous material intended to make people laugh, and there will be jokes and quips and other amusing things. I mean, we'd no idea what we were going to do. And the man trusted our talent. He looked at us, and we thought he was just going to say, get out and go away, do some thinking. And he said, go make 13 programs. And I think because we didn't have any kind of theory, that enabled us to start without any kind of preconception. And we just sat down and tried to do something new because we were bored with the conventions of comedy, the way that shows were normally presented. And we were bored with that. And boredom is a great force for creativity. People get bored and they start trying to do something different. You see what I mean? And we found a way of doing something different. And people used to say to us, well, what do you call this kind of humor? And of course, we didn't have an answer because we didn't sit around trying to describe what we were going to do. We just tried to make each other laugh. And it happened that we all had an absurdist sense of humor, and that the idea of a man with a tape recorder up his nose just struck us as being funny, funny, whereas those people would just look at each other in a rather bewildered way and think, how could anybody be moved by that? So, and I think the good thing about that is that most of life on this planet is far, far sillier and more ridiculous than we're brought up to believe. And you think it's very good. Somebody said to me early on after Monty Python, they watched the Python show, they couldn't watch the news afterwards because they couldn't take it seriously. But I think that's very helpful. I think one of the problems in our lives is that people seem to think that they know what they're doing, and very few people know what they're doing, and even less know what they're talking about. You know? So if you take that as a starting point, I think you're likely to be much saner than if you believe in all this nonsense.
John Cleese is our guest here, and joining us, he's coming to Rochester for a showing of Monty Python and the Holy Grail and for a discussion, a Q&A. And, you know, John, as you mentioned, with absurdist humor, you know, you and Terry and the group were just sort of doing what you wanted to do to make each other laugh. I saw an interview in which Ricky Gervais says that there is a received wisdom in the UK that Americans don't get irony, which is not true, but he says what is true is that they don't use it as often as the Brits do. And I'm curious to know, because in the United States, there's a general understanding of what is meant by the term British humor. In Britain, what would the general view be of what constitutes American humor?
That's very interesting. I think there's a couple of basic assumptions people make which are wrong. I mean, people have said to me many times, oh, I love British humor. You know, Monty Python and Benny Hill. Well, that's hilarious. Monty Python and Benny Hill have almost nothing to do with each other. They're completely different types of humor. Mm-hmm. And what I've always felt is that the American humor that appeals to me, and I grew up watching Jack Benny and George Burns and Phil Silvers, who were wonderful, and then I learned a little bit about what was his name, Mort Sahl, you know, I mean, what an extraordinary, great satirical comedian he was. And then I got on to Bob Newhart, then I discovered Nichols and May. You had some of the very best humor, but what I notice about America is there's a very different sense of humor in, by and large, in the Midwest and the South than there is from the coasts and the Great Lakes. Because in the Midwest and the South, I'm not talking about the big cities, because there are always more sophisticated people who understand the irony of the big cities. But there are large areas of America where people don't get irony. And I had a family member once who just didn't get it. He was born in Indianapolis, and if you said something to him, he always thought you meant exactly what the words meant. Mm-hmm. And the idea of being in any way ironic or sarcastic, he just didn't get it. Now, that's an enormously different sense of humor from what you get in New York or San Francisco, the coasts, or you know, up in Michigan. So that's the big difference, is the people who get irony and the people who don't. I think the English may use irony more because they are very feeble about being direct about anything. They don't like a very direct conversation full of truth. They rather sort of use funny voices and talk around the subject, you know. Whereas Americans really taught me to speak much more directly about things. So I think we sometimes use irony because we don't really like just being open about things. But it's a very complicated answer, but I think there's an awful lot of truth in what I'm saying.
I think so. And I think right now, even comedy is becoming politicized, or at least pulled into the political sphere. Comedian and commentator Sam Bee recently, you probably saw, John, Samantha Bee did apologize for using some direct and crude language about Ivanka Trump, language that I will not repeat on this program. Do you think she was right to apologize? Did she cross any line there?
Yeah, I think that kind of very vulgar abuse doesn't get anyone anywhere. And I think there are really good political jokes. I mean, you see, I've been following American politics for so long, I can remember Adlai Stevenson, who used to run against Eisenhower. And I remember hearing Adlai Stevenson, this would have been the mid-50s, saying to a big Democratic conference, if the Republicans will stop telling lies about us, we will stop telling the truth about them. I thought that was terribly funny. It's a very good joke. And I always thought you had very, very good political commentators. I thought Will Rogers was one of the best. I read one something by him this morning. He said, our foreign policy is an open book. Unfortunately, it's a checkbook. We've always had some very good, witty commentators in America. But I've now forgotten what the question was. What was
We are talking to John Cleese. We had asked him about Samantha Bee. And let me, John, let me go ahead and quote your Twitter feed.
Oh, yeah. I think okay. Vulgar abuse doesn't help. But I think if you make a deep joke, I mean, there was a magnificent joke last week, and that is this. Kim, what's her name? Kardashian.
Yeah.
Went to the White House to discuss prison reform with the President of the United States. Now, I mean, jokes don't get any funnier.
John Cleese, my guest for a few more minutes, and he's very active on Twitter. You've got a lot to say about politics. Just this morning you wrote, quote, I think there are a lot of decent people in the UK who have no idea how corrupt we have become, end quote. And certainly some Americans, yes, might feel that way. Do you have a sense of how we arrived at this moment when so many citizens are almost gleeful about corruption, whether it's in the UK or here, as long as it serves the end goal, which is just to spite the ideological opposition?
This is such a vast subject. I think what's, thank God, this is where my mind freezes at the thought of all the possibilities that I could say about it at this point. I think what I feel is this, that a lot of organized religion was rubbish. But not everything in religion was rubbish, but a lot of it was rubbish. I mean, I remember writing a line years ago, we fetched a character called Vice Pope Eric, and he was talking about Christ's teaching, and he said, you know, when you're trying to propagate a teaching of humility and poverty and tolerance, you need a very rich, powerful, authoritarian organization to do it. Now, I think that's a very good joke. Here you have the Catholic Church, which is very rich, very powerful, and very authoritarian, trying to teach what Christ taught. What Christ was trying to teach, if you read the Beatitudes, all that stuff about blessed are the poor in spirit. That's about getting trying to reduce the power of your ego. You know, it has that in common with Buddhism. Any proper religion is about trying to reduce the power of our egos. And yet this religion is in the hands of a group of people, an organized church, which is behaving entirely egotistically because it's trying to become bigger and powerful, more powerful and richer. So it's an inborn contradiction. But I think that as religion has slowly collapsed in most parts of the world, there's been a vacuum of values. And when that happens, people always turn to money. And if there is one doctrine that is causing more problems than anything else in the world, I think it's this. It's people who say that it's a moral duty to increase one's bottom line as far as one can, to make as much money as possible as a moral duty. And once you've got to that, I think the civilization collapses. Mm.
John Cleese, my guest, and I've got probably time for one more question before we offend you and take too much of your time, John. So I'm panicked. I'm looking at my long list of questions, and I realized I'm just going to have to see you on July 27th in Rochester.
Ask me the date of a battle. Ask me the date of any battle in history, and I'll tell you.
I'm not going to waste your time with that. But I'm going to get back to why you're coming to Rochester, which is Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You know, I was going to ask you how improvised the Frenchman on top of the castle scenes were, but I'll wait till you're here in Rochester for that. I will ask you this.
No, I'll tell you, none of it was improvised at all.
We were six
writers who happened to perform our own material. It was all about what was on the page,
okay.
The script.
All right, very good. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, is in terms of scene writing, Monty Python is, you know, at the very, very top for me in terms of scene writing. But we already talked before you joined the program this hour about the argument, which happens to have an ending in which you poke fun at your own group's occasional struggles to find the right ending for a scene. You joked in that sketch about how you often bring the police in to call the scene to an end, which is exactly what you did in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And I wanted to ask you how difficult it is to end a scene. How difficult and how important is it to end a scene? And do you look back and wish you had done any of that differently?
No, because what we found was that some scenes do have a natural ending and others don't. And we used to spend hours trying to find a really good ending when there actually wasn't one out there. And so what we used to do is, you know, we used to just abandon sketches in the middle, have Graham Chapman come in and say, this is getting too silly. And that way, if the sketch did have a good ending, we kept it. But otherwise, we didn't waste a lot of time on trying to find an ending that wasn't actually there. So I think that was one of the smartest things we did.
And as you look back at Holy Grail, I don't know how else you would have ended that, but you're happy with the close of Holy Grail?
Well, the ending is terrible. We get away with it. I mean, people say, why'd you end it like that? The answer is, it was the best thing to think of.
John Cleese is coming to Rochester on July 27th at the Kodak Center, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are on sale now at the Kodak Center box office and online. And he will not only be here for the screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but also for a Q&A that will follow. You're generous with your time, John. Thank you. We will see you here in Rochester next month.
And please ask the people who come to the show to ask nice, rude questions.
On it.
John Cleese, our guest here. Let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to talk to our panelists about some of what they heard there. I've got another clip from the film, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, that I'd like to share. And we'll broaden the discussion as well. We'll take some of your feedback as well, right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about Alzheimer's and dementia. And some experts in the field feel that systemically, we're getting a lot wrong in how we approach it, how we talk to families and patients, what our expectations are, what should change. We'll discuss all of that and want to hear from you next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You just heard John Cleese, legendary comedian and actor who is coming to Rochester for a show at the Kodak Center. Want to tell you, by the way, that WXXI is going to be offering tickets to the showing of Monty Python and the Holy Grail and the appearance of John Cleese. If you watch the broadcast of Fawlty Towers on Saturdays, the 16th and the 23rd, 9:30 p.m. on WXXI TV, you can have a chance to win tickets to see John Cleese at the Kodak Center. So tune into Fawlty Towers. We could probably do an hour on Fawlty Towers if we want. But Fawlty Towers on the 16th and 23rd, 9:30 p.m., WXXI TV, which is, I know, where you have your regular viewing habits anyway. So you probably already knew that, but now, you know, you can win tickets to see John and see the film coming up here. There's a lot of places I want to go with this. I want to start with Chris Thompson on a couple of things here. Number one, John Cleese clearly is not a comedian who thinks that the world is in such a dire point that we can't joke anymore. He still thinks there's real sort of, you know, poisonous power in comedy to make a point, but he doesn't think it always has to be crudely done. And I want to start by asking you if you agree. Are we still at a time where we can laugh at things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no way to get through the day without laughing. I don't know how people can be so serious and so stern all the time. That, you need to be able to laugh. You need to be able to look at these things, no matter how grave they are. There's usually nothing that can't be, you know, not taken lightly, but nothing that you cannot satirize. Like, pretty much everything's on the board. It's just a matter of how it's done.
Okay.
It's the tastefulness of it that, and that's what he was talking about. Like, being vulgar and everything is cheap. You know, there's a way to joke about these things without being gross about it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so like when I asked him about Samantha Bee, and I thought his answer, I understood the point. I think you can do two things with the Sam Bee thing. I think you could acknowledge the utter hypocrisy of anybody who wants to be upset about what Samantha Bee said without recognizing a couple of things. Number one, Samantha Bee was using a term to make a point to attack someone who is defending perceived misogyny and a patriarchy, when a lot of people use the term that Samantha Bee used to promote patriarchy and misogyny.
Yes.
So there's that. But there's also, obviously, we can look at Ted Nugent, who used that term to talk about Hillary Clinton, and he gets invited for a photo op at the White House. So there's all this selective outrage. Mm-hmm. You can say that that's hypocritical to get upset about that while still saying it's not the best way to advance an argument.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the rage over Sam Bee, like the word that she used, I totally get. Like, she could as talented as she is, she could have used a different word. But the fact that the rage that she got is the same amount of rage that, say, Michelle Wolf got when she just said Sarah Huckabee Sanders lies and she uses them to, you know, do her makeup. See, that's funny, but not vulgar. But people acted like it was vulgar.
Yeah, I think there was some faux outrage there. Allison Roberts, how did you feel about the Samantha Bee thing? Are you with John Cleese there that it was maybe not the best way to make a point?
Yeah, I'm a big Sam Bee fan, and you know, when we're writing and we're trying to think of, you know, ways to say things, we do ask, like, do we have to dip down into that bag? Do we have to? Is there a better way to put this? Is there a more intelligent way to write this? Is there a more intelligent way to come at something as opposed to leaping into that lower fruits of the tree, as it were?
Okay, there's got to be a really good reason, I guess, huh?
There's got to be a good reason. I mean, I think, you know, like certain characters, so creating a certain character who says certain things that work for that character is different than grabbing at something that's vulgar for the sake of shocking or, you know,
yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. Terry, how do you feel about the question on whether it can be too vulgar? I mean, Monty Python and the Holy Grail was at times a little gross out, but it was rarely as vulgar as we see with the likes of Samantha Bee. Now, again, I'm not taking a position one way or another. I'm just observing the one, in this particular case, the word choice. But how do you feel about that?
Yeah, they always did it with a great sense of fun, and that word irony comes in, too. They use a great deal of irony. I always thought Monty Python was very close to realism. And if you know England at all, you realize it is very close to realism. I lived in England a lot, and I was there in 1969 when they came out. Unfortunately, I didn't have a television, so I wasn't aware of them. I was spending my time in the theater or at pubs, including one that had the last music hall in London, The Green Man in Blackheath, which used much humor and sketch things like they did. So they came out of that kind of tradition, too. And they used kind of crude things. Flatulence was very popular. But it never got down to that sort of disgusting level, as crude as it could be. No.
And by the way, do you agree with him, his take that in the United States, irony is not as common and not as well understood?
Yes, I do. Even my son said sometimes he doesn't know when I'm kidding or not because I use irony so much.
Yeah. That's perfect.
I'm going to grab a couple of phone calls in 1 second here. And listeners, if you want to weigh in, you can do that in various places. You can email connections@wxxi.org. You can email me, edawson@wxxi.org. You can find us on Twitter, and you can call 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And Michael in Penfield has a comment on the Samantha Bee affair. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the show. I kind of have a standard that I use for comments such as those that Samantha Bee made is I hold it up and say, would I be upset, bothered, irritated, irate, whether someone used the term for my wife or daughter or mother? And if someone called my wife, daughter, or mother that, would I be upset? Would I think it'd be out of place? And that's my standard, anyway. That's just a thought. Thanks.
Okay, Michael, thank you very much. Everyone's got different lines, and for them, different places where a line has been crossed. 844-295-TALK if you want to weigh in. Before I grab Walter and Brockport's comment, I wanted to also ask about something else. I didn't have time to ask John Cleese, but I'm very keen to see how things play out in Rochester, because when he does these Q&As, he gets asked about Monty Python and the Holy Grail. He gets asked about the different sketches they've done. He gets asked about politics. He was asked whether the Queen had Diana killed. I mean, he gets asked all kinds of things.
What?
I know, it's just bizarre. I think Terry was asked that question. He and Terry were at a show one time, and someone asked, we want to know the truth. Did the Queen have Diana killed? And so he'll get asked anything, and he enjoys that. But, you know, Chris, I'm thinking of a description he had of one event in the United States recently, where they showed the film and they're doing questions, and one audience member who was a Donald Trump supporter said they didn't like John's politics and he left and just walked out of the theater. And I guess John Cleese was very polite to him and very kind and said, let's give him a round of applause for being here because most of my viewers or my fans are probably going to be rather progressive in their politics, so at least let's show him a little support that way. He wasn't vitriolic. But it still, to me, speaks to how we have a hard time being in the room with somebody who disagrees with us. And I don't like that. And I think, I wonder, does comedy reinforce that? Is there any way around that? I mean, should we be willing to kind of still mix it up, or are we still kind of, are we making ourselves even more tribalized?
I don't think we're being tribalized. I think the tribalism that was already there is just being more televised. I never thought that John Cleese or Monty Python or any of that was on any side of the fence. Like, I thought it was just universally thought funny. So that's surprising that anyone can derive any
Probably less from the film, more from what Cleese says in person and sharing his own politics. But then this person decided, well, I don't like it. I'm leaving.
I mean, that's his choice, but even with what he said, this could be my own bias that I'm projecting on things that I've heard him said and things that I've read.
Sure.
But I haven't seen much, you know, that he said that would be on, you know, any, you know, maybe it's a little bit more progressive, but it's just because he's a funny guy. He wants everybody to laugh, which is a little bit more inclusive.
Yeah. Allison, when you were writing sketches, there are times where you're writing sketches that are just purely funny, and there are times where you're making a point. Do you have conversations with the AstroFest team members about, are we pushing too far here? Is this going to alienate some? Do we want to alienate some? Or do we want to make people uncomfortable? How do you have those discussions?
We have them all the time. Mm-hmm. And ironically, we just one of the cast members just wrote something that will possibly be, you know, press some buttons. And we talked about it and we're like, is this okay? Or is this, are we too divisive here? Is this going to, and then there was part of us that was like, so what? Like, you know, let's take the risk. Let's throw it out there. Let's, you know, push the envelope a little bit. So usually we all agree, but we have to find that place because there's a line between, you know, playing it too safe where you never take the risks and then it's kind of boring, I think. And taking that leap. We have a disclaimer on our program booklet that says we look to offend everyone anyway. So if you don't feel offended, let us know and we'll take care of it later.
So. See, I need to take notes from you because I like to push buttons with my comedy, but I need to draw more people in before I push them.
Let me go ahead and grab Walter in Brockport because you heard Terry earlier this hour mention the dead parrot sketch, and Walter has a comment about that. Go ahead, Walter.
When Margaret Thatcher, not my favorite prime minister, referred to an impending bill in Parliament as, quote, a dead parrot, and then she went through the whole routine, that parrot had expired. It is no more. It is extinct, and on and on and on. I had two reactions. Number one, perhaps the old babe is not as bad as I thought she was. Number two, it speaks to the point you guys made earlier, how much skits from Monty Python have entered the, at least in England, the common cultural flow. I just love that whole thing.
That's also, thank you, Walter. By the way, Terry, that's a great reference for a bad piece of legislation, a dead parrot bill. Never
yes,
had any
is.
Life to begin with. Can't believe it. That's how you must know you've made it, right?
I
when you enter
so.
The lexicon?
I guess so. Isn't that wonderful?
I wonder what else. So here's another thing that's entered the lexicon in this country. Flesh wound. You know, it's just a flesh wound is how we say, you know, come on, it's no big deal. Of course, it refers to the Black Knight scene where the arm's off. Your arm's off? No, it isn't. It's just a flesh wound. So there's one. Will you have known you've made it, Allison Roberts, when someone is referring to one of your characters? Yeah, because it's going to happen for one of your characters or one of your sketches. It's going to be quoted, probably by the White House. That's when you'll know you've made it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Until then.
Until then, yeah. We'll
middling.
We'll just hang out here in Rochester and middle it. Yeah.
Yeah, there are certain things that will break through, Chris. What's the standard of making it in comedy? I mean, because you could chase it your whole life, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I guess for me, it would be, well, just like you were saying, if something that I said or some, well, I don't have any catchphrases or anything, but if something that I said winds up making it on a national level and it's now just like common, like a common saying, then, you know, there it is. But well, I don't know, just living a good, just making people laugh is the way I think.
And
I
making
made
a little
it.
Money from it, making a living from it would be good.
Being able to make a living, not being rich, just being able to make a living, like this is what I do. This is my job. I'm an engineer. I'm a humor engineer, you know, something like that.
And where can people find you?
Oh, I'm putting that in my card.
I like that. You just thought of it. Where can people find you?
I'm at, well, on Instagram and Twitter at Crons of Non. I have a website called thechroniclesofnonsense.com. And also, almost Tuesday, I have a skit, The Chronicles of Nonsense, where I do actual live skits, most of them political in nature, usually humorous, hopefully all of them humorous. So that's on another radio station on WAYO.
Yeah, WAYO.
WAYO.
And there you
yes.
go, 104.3. You got a lot of friends over at WAYO. Yes. Estro's doing another show this year?
We'll be in Fringe at Jiva.
You're going to be in Fringe at Jiva. Oh, so yeah. Before I listen to one more clip from Monty Python, I wanted to ask Allison Roberts about your thoughts on what John Cleese had to say about blow lines, about ending scenes. It's very hard sometimes to come up with the right way to end a sketch.
Yes.
And so he was basically saying, some sketches don't really have good endings, and we punted, and we don't feel bad about that. Is that, look, not to be ungenerous to John Cleese, is that given up too easily? Do you think there's an ending for every sketch, and sometimes just says, does it take hours or days to find it?
Yes, and I was so relieved to hear him say that. Because now I can just walk off the stage. No.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, you know, that I actually took notes on that because that, to me, those sketches ending, you know, with the colonel coming in and smacking somebody over the head with a rubber chicken or heading into another sketch right after that sketch that didn't end and all those creative ways of getting out of things, yes. Sometimes it's days and days of trying to figure out how to land the freaking plane, you know? Just and sometimes it's a punchline and sometimes it isn't. And sometimes a punchline is too simple, but sometimes it works really well. So they're all really different, you know? But now I'm going to start putting graphics, more graphics in my show.
Yes.
I'm just going to, like, walk off stage.
Chris, was that given up too easily, you think, for John?
I was actually relieved, too, because I've done I've been doing, like, skit writing for the last 3 years, and I've not known how to end them. And it usually ends up in me killing my friend Woody off somehow. And that's getting tired. So
just killing Woody.
Sometimes I can, yeah, now I can just be like, all right, cool. Well, let's just jump out of this plane while it's going.
Yeah, John Cleese said that would be fine. Speaking of John Cleese and Monty Python and the Holy Grail coming to Rochester at the Kodak Center on July 27th. That's why John Cleese joined us earlier this hour. Here's one of my favorite scenes Monty Python ever did. It's from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and it's a scene in which King Arthur, riding across the countryside, or prancing, I guess, across the countryside, banging coconuts together, and he comes across a couple of people from the lower British classes who don't really even know that he's a king. And with all the talk we had on this program about whether we should abandon the monarchy, I went back and I watched the scene, and I thought, this is so good. Let's listen.
I order you to be quiet.
Order, oh, who does he think he is?
I'm your king.
Well, I didn't vote for you.
You don't vote for kings?
Well, how'd you become king, then?
The Lady of the Lake, her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite, held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Listen, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power derives from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony. Be quiet! But you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you. Shut up!
I love that so much. I'm killing Terry over here. I love it. It's bringing it all back here. That's probably a scene you haven't seen. That doesn't that feel like we just had a conversation about whether we still need a monarchy? And it all goes back to 1975, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
That's right.
They said it better than anybody there. You guys, don't you feel like that may have been a funny sketch, but there's a lot of truth. There's a lot of truth in comedy, and there was a lot of truth in that scene to
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Some things change, some things never change. It's all, you know.
So how much comedy should be about sending a message? Terry, when you used to watch Monty Python sketches, how much did you feel like, you know, I just wanted to laugh, or, boy, they made a point there?
Oh, I think it's all got to be based on some truth. And I'm not sure I want it to be making points, but it's got to be based on some sort of truth.
That's fair.
And, yeah. And I think it's very close to reality. Monty Python is close to English reality.
More and more all of our reality.
Well, I'm not sure about... Well, yes, to a certain extent. But the more you know about England, the more you realize it is very close to English reality, which can be pretty bizarre.
the bizarre has become the real. Allison, you agree that whether you're... There at least has to be a grounding of real experience in a sketch, even if it's not making a point. And do you think that there is any kind of a formula in your own mind for... I want this to make people laugh, but I want to make a point here?
Yes to both. Yeah, sometimes I want to make a point and make people laugh and get at the point without beating them over the head with it. And sometimes I just want something to be funny, but starting with real day-to-day, mundane, everyday stuff that's real and true is often the best starting place to write comedy from.
Chris?
I agree with that. Like most of what I do, I'm always trying to make a point, no matter what, you know, whether it's a personal experience or if I'm talking about something like a broader concept. I'm always trying to make a point with my comedy. It's not necessary. Sometimes you just want to laugh for laughing's sake, but I think it comes across more genuine when you're actually speaking to something that's important in someone's life.
All right, I'm going to end this program by asking our panelists to become the interviewer, because my time with John Cleese was so short, and I wanted to rope in so many more questions, and there were so many good ones we had via email and Twitter. So if you had one with John Cleese, what were you going to ask him? Allison Roberts, what would you ask John Cleese?
I'd ask him, going back to the Flying Circus, going back to the beginning of that particular group together, what pieces of that he misses, or does he miss those gentlemen and that time?
Chris Thompson.
I would ask him if he would like to be my uncle. Maybe like adopted uncle. I don't know if you can do that. But
there's
just
still
so
time.
I can say. There's still time. Yeah.
Dr. Brown.
Doctor yet? I'm still doctor.
You are.
I guess I'd like to ask him what he enjoyed most about working with them as a group, both as writers and especially playing off of each other.
It's a great point. And as Allison Roberts pointed out before the hour began, it's pretty well known that they would write in pairs. They wrote together and then brought the scripts to each other. Sometimes films like Monty Python came together because they were essentially sketches that they found a way to create an overarching plot. But it was a series of sketches that they would write in pairs. Mm-hmm. And we saw it come together. You can see it at the Kodak Center. Monty Python and the Holy Grail is screening at the Kodak Center on Friday, July 27th. John Cleese will be here, and then he will host a Q&A. After the showing. Tickets are on sale at the Kodak Center box office and online now. And if you want to win tickets, you ought to watch WXXI-TV on July 16th and 23rd, Saturdays, 9:30 p.m. for Fawlty Towers. That's a chance then, if you tune in, to win tickets to see Monty Python and the Holy Grail and to meet John Cleese. Our thanks to our guest, Terry Brown. Thank you. Great having you this hour. A lot of fun.
Thanks.
Allison Roberts, you can see Allison in Astrofest at Fringe this year. Talk to you again soon, I hope.
Thank you, Evan.
Chris Thompson, The Chronicles of Nonsense, online, on Instagram, on Twitter. See you soon. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
As always, much more connections coming up.